Chapter 4. I was busy in court over the next 2 days, but Thursday afternoon was free and I had arranged to take Roger to see Guy. It was Maundy Thursday, the day before Easter, and as I walked back from the court at Westminster to Lincoln's Inn, I saw the churches were again full. Tomorrow the great veil that shrouded the chancels during Lent would be removed, and those who cleaved to the old traditions would creep to the cross on their knees. After Mass, the altars would be stripped of their vestments in commemoration of Christ's betrayal after the Last Supper. While down at Whitehall, the king would wash the feet of 12 poor men. I felt sad at how little any of it meant to me now. There were 4 days' holiday to come, but to me they would be empty and dull. At least when Lent was over, Joan, my housekeeper, had promised me a roast saddle of beef. The weather was still cold, the sky iron grey, although there had been no more snow. I called in at my chambers before going to fetch Roger, and was pleased to see that a large fire had been lit. Barrack and my junior clerk, Skelly, were both busy at their desks. Barrack looked up as I took off my fur-edged coat and warmed my hands before the fire. He had had a shave on Sunday, but I noticed his brown doublet had a button missing, and there was what looked like a beer stain on the chest. I wondered if he had been out all night, and thought again about Tamasin. The two lived quite near Guy's shop, and I resolved that on the way back from taking Roger, I would call in on them as though by chance.
"I called at the court office," Barrack said. "They're going to hear Adam Kite's application next Tuesday, at the same time as the Collins case."
"Good." I was tempted to tell him to get his doublet cleaned up, but didn't want to sound like an old woman. And he knew enough not to come carelessly dressed to court. I looked quickly through a couple of new briefs that had come in, then donned my coat again.
"I'm going to take Master Elliard to Guy," I said.
Barrack had risen and was looking out of the window.
"What's wrong with that rogue Belknap?" he said curiously.
"Belknap?" I rose and joined him.
"Looks like he's about to peg out."
Through the window I saw my old rival sitting on a bench next to the still frozen fountain. A knapsack lay on the snow beside him. Even at this distance, his lean face looked an unhealthy white.
"What's the matter with him?"
I said.
"They say he's been faint and ill for weeks,"
Skelly said, looking at us earnestly from his table.
"I thought he looked under the weather at the play." "Let's hope it's nothing minor," Barrack said.
I smiled enigmatically.
"I must go."
I left them and walked back into Gatehouse Court. I had to pass the fountain to get to Roger's rooms. Belknap hadn't moved. His thin form was swathed in an expensive coat lined with marten, but even so, this wasn't weather to be sitting outside. I hesitated as I passed him.
"Brother Belknap," I asked, "are you all right?"
He looked at me quickly, then glanced away. He could never meet anyone's eye.
"Perfectly, brother," he snapped. "I just sat down for a moment."
"You've dropped your knapsack. It'll get wet."
He bent and picked it up. I saw his hand trembled.
"Go away,"
he said. I was surprised to see that he looked frightened.
"I only wish to help," I said stiffly.
"You help me?"
He gave a snort of mocking laughter, then forced himself to his feet and stumbled off towards his lodgings. I shook my head and passed on. Roger was in his outer office. A candle had been lit against the gloomy afternoon, and he stood before it, an affidavit in his long fingers.
"A moment, Matthew," he said with a smile.
His head moved rapidly, scanning the document, then he passed it to the clerk with a nod.
"Well done, Bartlett," he said. "A very fair draft. Now, Matthew, let's go and see this leech."
He smiled nervously.
"I see you have your riding boots. Sensible. I'll get mine. These shoes will be ruined in the slush."
He collected his boots, strong old leather ones he often wore, and We walked to the stables. "No more sudden falls?" I asked him quietly. "No, thank God," he sighed deeply. I could see he was still worried. "Have you much work on?" I asked to distract him. "More than I can handle." Roger was an excellent litigator and since returning to London had built up a formidable reputation. "But I have to go and see a new pro bono client tonight after we've been to the doctor's." A voice calling Roger's name made us turn. Dorothy was hurrying towards us, an amused expression on her face, carrying a package wrapped in oilskin. "You forgot this," she said. Her husband reddened as he took the package. "His urine bottle for the physician," Dorothy explained. Roger gave me a wry smile. "What would I do without her?" he asked. "Forget your head, husband." Dorothy smiled again, then shivered, for she wore only an indoor dress. "Go back in, sweetheart," Roger said, "or you'll have need of a doctor too." "I will. Good luck, my love. Goodbye, Matthew. Come to supper next week." She turned and walked away, hugging herself against the cold. "I hate deceiving her," Roger said. "She still thinks I have a bad stomach. But I wouldn't worry her."
"I know. Now come and take care you don't drop that package."
Roger was preoccupied, saying little as we rode along Cheapside. The traders were packing up their stalls and we had to pick our way between the few late shoppers and the discarded wooden boxes thrown in the road. A pair of barefoot children in rags darted perilously close to the horses' hooves, picking up rotten vegetables, the dregs of last year's produce which the traders had thrown away. The beggars were crowded around the conduit again, and one was waving a stick with a piece of rotten bacon on the end, shouting maniacally from the steps.
"Help Tom a Bedlam! Help a poor man out of his wits! See my broken heart here, on the end of this rod?"
"He's probably never been anywhere near the Bedlam," I said to Roger. "If all the beggars who say they've been there had truly been patients, the place would be the size of Westminster Hall."
"How is your client that has been put there?"
"Grievous sick in his mind. It's harrowing to see. I wish to ask Guy to visit him, and I hope he can make sense of it, for I cannot."
"Dr. Moulton specialises in madness, then?"
Roger gave me an anxious look. "Not at all," I answered reassuringly. "But he has been practising medicine for nearly 40 years and has seen every type of illness there is. And he's a good doctor. Not like so many physicians who know of no remedies save bleeding and purging." "'Tis but your own fear that tells you you might have the falling sickness. Symptoms of falling over can have 100 causes. And you have never had a ghost of a fit."
"I have seen those fits, though. I once had a client who suffered from them, and he fell down in my office, gibbering and foaming with only the whites of his eyes showing."
He shook his head. "It was a dreadful sight.
And it came on this man late in life."
"You experience these falls and fix your mind on the most frightening thing you have seen. If I didn't know you for a clever lawyer, I would call you a noddle." He smiled.
"Aye, perhaps."
To take his mind from his worries, I told him the story of the preacher who had stood at Newgate promising great rivers of blood. "Can a man who preaches such things possibly be a good man? A Christian man?" I asked, even though the next minute he was proclaiming the joys of salvation. He shook his head. "We are in a mad and furious world, Matthew. Mundus furiosus. Each side railing against the other, preaching full of rage and hatred. The radicals foretelling the end of the world, to the conversion of some and the confusion of many." He looked at me, smiling with great sadness. "Remember when we were young, how we read Erasmus on the foolishness of indulgences granted by the church for money?
the endless ceremonial and Latin masses that stood between ordinary people and the understanding of Christ's message?
Aye. That reading group we had. Remember Juan Viva's books about how the Christian prince could end unemployment by sponsoring public works, building hospitals and schools for the poor? But we were young, I added bitterly. And we dreamed.
A Christian commonwealth living in gentle harmony,
Roger sighed.
You realised it was all going rotten before I did.
I worked for Thomas Cromwell.
And I was always more radical than you.
He turned to me.
Yet I still believe that a church and state no longer bound to the Pope can be made into something good and Christian, despite the corruption of our leaders and all these new fanatics.
I didn't reply.
And you, Matthew?
He asked.
What do you believe now? You never say.
I no longer know, Roger, I said quietly. But come, we turn down here. Let's change the subject. The buildings are close together here, the voices echo, and we must be careful what we say in public these days. The sun was setting as we rode into the narrow alley in Bucklesbury where Guy lived and worked. It was full of apothecary shops, and Roger's face became uneasy as he saw the stuffed alligators and other strange wonders displayed in the windows. As we dismounted and tied our horses to a rail, he looked relieved to see that Guy's window contained only a selection of ornate apothecary's jars.
"Why does he practice in this godforsaken place if he's a physician?" Roger asked, retrieving his sample from his horse's pannier.
"Guy was only admitted to the College of Physicians last year after saving a rich alderman's leg. Before that, his dark skin and his being an ex-monk kept him out, despite his French medical degree. He could only practice as an apothecary."
"But why stay here now?"
Roger's face wrinkled in distaste at the sight of a baby monkey in a jar of brine in the adjacent window. "He says he's grown used to living here."
"Among these monsters?"
"They're just poor dead creatures," I smiled reassuringly. "Some apothecaries claim their powdered body parts can work wonders. Guy is not of that opinion." I knocked at his door. It was opened almost at once by a boy in an apprentice's blue coat. Piers Hubbardine was an apprentice apothecary whom Guy had taken on the year before. He was a tall, dark-haired lad in his late teens, with features of such unusual comeliness that he turned women's heads in the streets. Guy said he was hard-working and conscientious, a rarity among London's notoriously unruly apprentices. He bowed deeply to us.
"Good evening, Master Shardlake, and Master Elliard."
"Yes."
"Is that your sample, sir? May I take it?"
Roger handed it over with relief, and Piers ushered us into the shop.
"I'll fetch Dr. Moulton,"
he said, and left us.
I inhaled the sweet, musky scent of herbs that pervaded Guy's consulting room.
Roger looked up at the neatly labelled jars on the shelves. Little bunches of herbs were laid out on a table beside a mortar and pestle and a tiny goldsmith's weighing balance. Above the table was a diagram of the four elements and the types of human nature to which they correspond: melancholic, phlegmatic, cheerful, and choleric. Roger studied it.
"Dorothy says I am a man of air, cheerful and light," he observed.
"With a touch of the phlegmatic, surely. If your temperament was all air, you couldn't work as you do.
And you, Matthew, were always melancholic. Your dark colouring and spare frame mark you out."
"I wasn't so spare before my fever 18 months ago." I gave him a serious look. "I think that would have carried me off without Guy's care." "Don't worry, Roger. He'll help you." I turned with relief as Guy entered the room. He was 60 now, and his curly hair, black when first I knew him, was white, making the dark brown hue of his lean features even more striking by contrast. I saw that he was beginning to develop an aged man's stoop. When we had first become friends 6 years before, Guy had been a monastic infirmarian. The monasteries had housed many foreigners, and Guy came originally from Granada in Spain, where his forebears had been Muslims. Having abandoned a Benedictine habit for an apothecary's robe, he had now in turn exchanged that for the black, high-collared gown of a physician. When he came in, I thought his dark face seemed a little drawn, as though he had worries. Then he looked at us and smiled broadly.
"Good day, Matthew," he said.
His quiet voice still carried an exotic lilt.
"And you must be Master Eliard."
His penetrating dark eyes studied Roger closely. "I..." Roger shuffled nervously.
"Come through to my examination room. Let us see what the problem is."
"I have brought some urine, as you asked. I gave it to the boy."
"I will look at that."
He smiled.
"However, unlike some of my colleagues, I do not place entire reliance on the urine. Let us first examine you. Can you wait here a while, Matthew?"
"Of course." They left me. I sat on a stool by the window. The light was growing dim, the jars and bottles casting long shadows on the floor. I thought again of Adam Kite, and wondered uneasily whether Guy, still secretly loyal to the old church, might also say Adam was possessed. I had found myself thinking too over the last few days about the dark-haired woman keeper. What had she meant by saying she could never leave the bedlam? Was she under some permanent order of detention? The door opened and the boy Piers entered, carrying a candle and with a large book under his arm. He placed the book on the high shelf with several others, then went and lit the candles in a tall sconce. Yellow light flickered around the room, adding the smell of wax to the scent of herbs. He turned to me.
"Do you mind if I continue my work, sir?"
he asked.
"Please do."
He sat at the table, took a handful of herbs, and began grinding them. He rolled back the sleeves of his robe, revealing strong arms, the muscles bunching as he crushed the herbs. "How long have you been with Dr. Moulton now?" I asked.
"Just a year, sir."
He turned and smiled, showing sparkling white teeth.
"Your old master died, did he not?"
"Aye, sir. He lived in the next street. Dr. Moulton took me on when he died suddenly. I am lucky. He is a man of rare knowledge and kind."
"That he is," I agreed.
Piers turned back to his work. How different he was from most apprentices, noisy, lewd lads forever looking for trouble. His self-possessed, confident manner was that of a man, not a boy. It was an hour before Guy and Roger returned. It had grown dark and Piers had to bend closely to his work, a candle beside him. Guy put a hand on his shoulder.
"Enough for tonight, lad. Go and get some supper, but first bring us some beer."
"Yes, sir."
Piers bowed to us and left. I looked at Roger, delighted to see an expression of profound relief on his face.
"I do not have the falling sickness," he said, and beamed.
Guy smiled gently.
"The strangest matters may have a simple resolution. I always like to start by looking for the simplest possible explanation, which William of Ockham taught is most likely to be the true one. So, I began with Master Eliard's feet."
"He had me standing barefoot," Roger said. "Then measured my legs, laid me on his couch, and bent my feet to and fro. I confess I was surprised. I came expecting a learned disquisition on my urine."
"We did not need that in the end,"
Guy smiled triumphantly.
"I found the right foot turns markedly to the right, The cause being that Master Elliot's left leg is very slightly longer. It is a problem that has been building for years. The remedy is a special shoe with a wooden insert that will correct the gait. I will get young Pierce to make it. He is skilled with his hands.
I am more grateful than I can say, sir, Roger said warmly.
There was a knock, and Piers returned with three pewter goblets on a tray which he laid on the table.
Let us drink to celebrate Master Elliard's liberation from falling over.
Guy took a stool and passed another to Roger. Roger is thinking of starting a subscription for a hospital, I told Guy. Guy shook his head sadly.
Hospitals are sorely needed in this city. That would be a good and Christian thing. Perhaps I could help, advise.
That would be kind, sir.
Roger still holds to the ideals of Erasmus, I said. Guy nodded.
I once studied Erasmus too. He was in high favour when I first came to England. I thought when he said the church was too rich, too devoted to ceremony, he had something. Though most of my fellow monks did not. They said he wrote with a wanton pen.
His face grew sombre.
Perhaps they saw clearer than I that talk of reform would lead to the destruction of the monasteries, and of so much else. And for what? He asked bitterly. A reign of greed and terror.
Roger looked a little uncomfortable at Guy's defence of the monks. I looked from one to the other of them. Guy, who was still a Catholic at heart, Roger the radical reformer, turned moderate. I was not so much between them as outside the whole argument. A lonely place to be.
I have a case I wanted to ask your advice about, Guy, I said to change the subject. A case of religious madness, or at least perhaps that is what it is.
I told him Adam's story.
So the Privy Council have put him in the bedlam to get him out of the way, I concluded.
His parents want me to get him released, but I'm not sure that's a good idea.
I have known of obsessive lovers, Roger said, but obsessive praying? I have never heard of such a thing.
I have,
Guy said, and we both turned to look at his dark, grave face.
It is a new form of brain sickness. Something Martin Luther has added to the store of human misery.
What do you mean? I asked.
There have always been some people who hate themselves, who torture themselves with guilt for real or imagined offences. I saw such cases sometimes as an infirmarian. Then we could tell people that God promises salvation to any who repent their sins because he places no one outside his mercy and charity.
He looked up, a rare anger in his face.
But now some tell us that God has decided, as though from caprice, to save some and damn others to perpetual torment. And if God does not give you the assurance of his grace, you are doomed. That is one of Luther's central doctrines. I know. I have read him. Luther may have felt himself a worthless creature saved by God's grace, but did he ever stop to think what his philosophy might mean for those without his inner strength, his arrogance?
If that were true, Roger said, surely half the population would be running mad.
Do you believe you are saved?
Guy asked suddenly.
That you have God's grace?
I hope so. I try to live well and hope I may be saved.
Yes. Most, like you or I, are content with the hope of salvation and leave matters in God's hands. But now there are some who are utterly certain they are saved. They can be dangerous because they believe themselves special, above other people. But just as every coin has two sides, so there are others who crave the certainty yet are convinced they are unworthy. And that can end in the piteous condition of this young man. I have heard it called salvation panic, though the term hardly does justice to the agonies of those who suffer it.
He paused.
The question, perhaps, is why the boy became consumed with guilt in the first place. Maybe he has committed some great sin, I said.
I was glad to see Guy shake his head.
No, usually in such cases their sins are small. It is something in the workings of their minds that brings them to this pass.
Will you help me try to find what it is, Guy? Some in the Bedlam think Adam is possessed. I fear they may do him harm.
I will come and see him, Matthew, Guy said. I will go as a doctor, of course, not an ex-monk. But he would probably fear he was indeed in the hands of the devil.
Suddenly my friend looked old and tired.
Thank you, I said. Young Pierce seems a hard worker, I observed. Yes, he is. A good apprentice. Perhaps better than I deserve, he added quietly.
How so? I asked, puzzled. He didn't answer.
Piers is very clever, too. His understanding is marvellous quick.
Guy gave a sudden smile that transformed his face.
Let me show you something I have been discussing with Piers. Something new in the world of healing that many of my fellow physicians disapprove of.
He rose and crossed to his shelf of books. He took down the big volume that Piers had replaced earlier. He cleared a space on the table and placed it there carefully. Roger and I went over to join him.
De humani corpora fabrica, Guy said quietly.
The workings of the human body. Just published. A German merchant friend brought it over for me.
It is by Andreas Vesalius, a Dutch physician working in Italy. They have been allowed to practice dissection of bodies there for years, though it has been forbidden here till recently.
The old church disapproved, Roger said.
They did, and they were wrong. Vesalius is the first man to dissect human bodies on a large scale for centuries, perhaps ever. And you know what he has found? That the ancients, Hippocrates and Galen, the ultimate authorities whom a physician may not question without risking expulsion from the College of Physicians, were wrong.
He turned to us, a gleam in his dark eyes.
Vesalius has shown that the ancients erred in many of their descriptions of the inner form of the body. He concludes they too were not allowed to dissect bodies, and that their descriptions came from studies not of men, but of animals. He laughed. This book will cause a great stir. The college will try to have it discredited, even suppressed.
But how can we know Vesalius is right and the ancients wrong? I asked.
By comparing his descriptions and drawings here with what we can see for ourselves when a body is opened. Four bodies of hanged criminals the Barber Surgeons' College is allowed now for public dissection.
I quailed a little at his words, for I was ever of a squeamish disposition. But he went on,
and there is another way I have been able to see for myself.
How so? Roger asked.
A London coroner can call for a body to be opened and examined if it is needed to find out how a man died. Most physicians think the work beneath them, and the pay is not great, but I have offered my services, and already I have been able to test Vesalius's claims for myself. And he is right.
Guy opened the book slowly, and almost reverentially. It was in Latin, illustrated with drawings that were marvellously executed, but with something mocking and even cruel about them. As Guy flicked over the pages, I saw a skeleton leaning on a table in the pose of a thinker, a flayed body hanging from a gibbet, all its innards exposed. In the corner of a drawing of exposed bowels, a little cherub sat passing a turd and smiling at the reader. Guy laid the book open at a picture of a human heart cut open on a table.
There, he said. Do you see? The heart has four chambers. Four, not the three we have always been taught.
I nodded, though all I could see was a horrible tangle of valves and tissue. I glanced at Roger. He was looking a little pale. I said, That's very interesting, Guy, but a little beyond us, I fear. And we must be getting back to Lincoln's Inn.
Oh, very well.
Guy, normally the most sensitive of men, didn't seem to realise the book had disturbed us. He smiled.
Perhaps this new year heralds in a time of wonders. I hear a Polish scholar has published a book proving by observation of the planets that the Earth goes round the sun, not the other way around. I have asked my friend to bring me a copy. This new year of 1543 may find us on the threshold of a new world.
Do you know many foreign merchants? Roger asked curiously.
We of alien looks or words must stick together.
Guy smiled sadly. He brought our coats and Roger left his fee of a mark. Guy promised the inserts for his shoes would be ready in a couple of weeks at most. We left, Roger thanking Guy again profusely for his help. When the door was closed, Roger clasped my arm. I cannot tell you how grateful I am for your guiding me to Dr. Moulton. I will ever be in your debt.
There are no debts between friends, I said with a smile. I'm glad to have helped.
I could have done without the dissection book, though, he added, as we rode away. We rode on up Bucklersbury. We passed the ancient mansion from Henry III's time, the old barge, long converted into a warren of crumbling tenements. Barak and Tamasin lived there.
Roger, do you mind if I leave you to go on? I asked. There's a visit I'd like to pay.
He looked up at the barge, raising his eyebrows.
Not some doxy, he asked. I hear many live there. No, my clerk and his wife. And I shall go and see my new client.
What is the case?
I don't know yet. A solicitor has sent me a letter about a client of his who has some property dispute over in Southwark. His client is too poor to pay for a barrister, but he says the case is a worthy one and asked if I'll act pro bono. It's all a bit vague, but I agreed to go and meet the client.
Who's the solicitor?
A man called Nantwich. I've never heard of him. There are so many jobbing solicitors looking for work around the inns these days.
He drew his coat round him.
It's cold for riding. I would rather go home and quietly celebrate the end of my fears.
He turned his horse, then paused. The air was heavy with wood smoke and chill with frost.
Where is spring? He asked.
Ben waved a hand in farewell and rode off into the dark night. I dismounted and walked towards the lighted windows of the old barge.